Okay, we are recording.
How long are we going to do this for?
2.5 hours.
What?
Usually it goes like 45, between 45 and 60 minutes.
Okay. 16?
Between 45 and 16. It goes backwards.
Boy. We might get into an argument during this podcast.
I hope so.
Time is, time's a loop. Right?
Yeah.
It's 1:35. So we'll be done by 2:35 at the latest.
At the latest.
2:30.
Yeah.
Johnny's
probably just started.
All right, I'm gonna start.
Has this started yet?
It's about to.
You should include this though.
Hi, welcome to the UCB Theater New York podcast. This is episode, I don't know, 38, 39, some shit.
That's right.
Across from me is Will Hines.
Across from me is John Frusciante.
I said across from me. Are you gonna edit that out in post?
Yeah, I'm gonna fix every mispronunciation. Yeah, I'm meticulous about that.
Thank you.
Yep.
And next to us is John Gemberling.
Hi, John.
Hi.
John Gemberling, member of Death by Ruru, longtime improviser.
Founding member.
Yeah, longtime improviser and performer at the UCB Theater.
Yes, that's right. That is the words he said.
Yeah.
One of the funniest people at this theater.
Yes.
And what
why?
Else? I don't know why. It's weird how that happens.
It's your looks.
And
thank you.
And you've been involved in a lot of cool stuff over the years. You and Curtis Gwynn had a TV show on Adult Swim, Fat Guys Stuck in Internet.
That's right.
Based on the successful Channel 102 show Gemberling, which was one of the best shows ever to come out of 102.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And and lots of other fun stuff. Doc and Change, the zombie show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just millions.
Couple of sketch shows.
Big
one
heist.
Of my favorite sketch shows ever at the UCB Theater, which was the one that you did with Curtis and Gemberling and John Daly. What the fuck was the name of that show?
I remember.
You were
see
in
it.
Oh, you remember the name.
Brighter Side.
The Brighter Side,
With Gelman.
Yeah. Did I say Gemberling?
He said Curtis and Gemberling. And
oh,
Daly.
Jesus. Sorry. Gelman.
I'll fix that in post when I fix it.
Yeah, please
the
do. Just take me out of this podcast and replace me with something more charming.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
great
you
sketch shows.
So
Big
much.
Heist is a great sketch show. And then you guys did there was one you just did once or twice, right?
There was one we did at the Mr. Chelsea Pleasant. Playhouse, How to Live Comfortably.
Yeah.
With Joe Wangert as
Mr. Pleasant,
Mr. Comfortable, or something like that. You want to fix your phone?
No, it's all right. It's fine. Okay. It's on silent.
So John, you've done a million funny things.
Yeah, I also brought some petite vanilla bean scones.
Oh, yeah.
Very nice.
Starbucks.
Mm-hmm. He's trying to up the ante for Mike Still's
Mike
sandwiches.
Mike Still started a wonderful tradition.
A few weeks back.
Is this an upping of an ante?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They're sort of...
Ooh, it's very nice. Vanilla bean scones. Yeah, you can't beat this.
They're sort of like a biscuit-looking thing with a white crust drizzled on top.
Yeah, it's
this
good.
Is turning into like an NPR Saturday morning sports show.
I hope so. I've had a couple of meetings with the NPR sports department without you, Will.
That's fine.
I know you get freaked out in meetings.
I get freaked out. I can't handle the pressure.
I'm trying to sell us to the NPR sports department.
It's our dream.
I convinced them that improv is a sport.
It's on NPR. It would be.
So, John, how did you find the UCB Theater?
Well, pretty boring. I watched the show, you know, so I knew about the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Yeah.
Then I was in a band.
The Loose Nuts.
For a few years. The Loose Nuts. We were a punk ska band.
American Pie soundtrack.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, you were on the American Pie soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. We had a song on the American Pie soundtrack. God, I'm killing with you guys. But then everybody started like going to college and we sort of had a tough time continuing. And, you know, ska was sort of falling out of fashion and we were sort of struggling for a continued identity as a band. And I had always wanted to do acting, even, you know, as a little kid. So then my friend Doug, whom I met sort of through doing stuff with the band, started taking classes at Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. Mm-hmm. You know Doug. You remember Doug.
Yeah, he was in my level one
and,
class.
And, boy, that phone just gets louder and louder every time it buzzes. Anyway, so then...
Keep talking. I'm going to address my phone.
Okay.
I just started taking classes, and it sort of became its own world from there.
I felt like, at the very beginning, Doug was more into it than you. Like, he kind of... He talked you into it or something like that?
Doug was more into everything than me, though. He was a very, like, excited.
Oh, okay.
He would go down to Washington Square Park and, like, breathe fire.
Hmm.
He was a more, like, extroverted, sort of hanging out with people kind of guy. And I was more of a judgmental sort of, I'm better than everybody.
Now, when you came to UCB to start with, you were pretty young, right? Weren't you 18 years old, I think?
I was 18. I was almost 19. Yeah. I was 18. I was a virgin.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't. Oh, I did know that. Yeah, because I remember, like, being in McManus right after one of your class shows for your level one or level two show, and I was not in that class, but I was taking a one that was happening at the same time. And being in McManus and them and the your classmates saying, "Oh yeah, John's going to his prom this week."
Oh yeah.
Or something like that. Like that was happening around the time of your level two grad show, I think.
Yeah, Jessica Sinclair wanted me to take her to my prom.
Can you imagine? It'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
I always thought she was kidding.
Do you think she was? She probably would have done it if you took her up.
Partially kidding, but I think she would have done it.
Yeah, if you took
her up. But she was dating Dan. I mean, she's...
Her now husband, yeah. Mm-hmm. She was already... But just even as to bring this, like, kind of, like, attractive, like, mid-20s actress to, like, your prom, would that be cool? I don't even know. Do New York high schools have different things going on where different stuff...
And
my high school would have blown people away.
Yeah.
It wouldn't... Well, my prom was, like, we didn't really stay long. It was like a city, it was like a bunch of schools, so like it wasn't really that fun.
A bunch of schools together at one prom?
Because I went to an all-boys school, so then it was the girls' schools and this. We only stayed for a little while, and then we
took
a limo.
Which high school
was this? It was Collegiate, the oldest private school in the city.
Huh.
1600s, dates back to.
Mm-hmm. Jesus Christ.
You know, we don't ask people their sexual status enough on this podcast.
Their sexual orientation?
No. I mean,
he mentioned
he was a virgin when he came to the theater. We don't include that when we say,
that,
like,
yeah.
How did you find the theater? We don't say, like,
we should get
virgin.
Right into it.
Yeah.
Right
like,
away,
say,
how many the first women had you slept with?
Yeah. Or, like, where were you at when you came to the theater? How many women had you slept with? If
how
any,
many
or how many men,
men
had
yeah.
you
yeah.
slept with?
We'll try to add that in.
Yeah, we gotta. I'm gonna call the NPR people and tell them we're adding that in.
Well, anyway, I don't know if it would have been cool to anybody. She probably would have felt awkward.
Yeah, she would have regretted going along with that bit
when
she was in a room full of 17 and 18-year-old boys.
It only would have been cool, though, if I had fucked her.
But instead, didn't you bring a blow-up doll to your prom?
I brought a blow-up sex doll.
You did?
My dad made a little silver lamé dress for...
So, like, did you have any interest in acting at that point, or... I mean, you were young compared to most people who were at the theater. I mean, it's a young theater, and you were younger than everybody. So did you have an interest in acting or comedy or anything before that, or was this like a lark that you tried out and then kind of liked?
Well, I always wanted to do acting, even before I did music.
Okay.
You had said when you were a kid you wanted to act, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a dream that I still remember. I loved Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Okay.
I watched all of Schwarzenegger's movies.
Uh-huh.
Not that I thought he was like... the best actor, but
yeah.
I just loved him.
Yeah.
I had a dream, a very, like, almost lucid dream when I was a kid that I was, like, in a movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Really?
And it was, like, we were, like, walking around together and hanging out, and then I woke up and I was so disappointed.
That's
I was
life.
So jealous of Austin O'Brien.
I don't know who
Which
that
one
is.
He was the kid from The Last Action Hero.
I see.
That fucking kid.
Yeah, you were probably like 12 or 13 when that was out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He was also in Lawnmower Man and the Full Moon production Pre-Hysteria. Oh, Half Moon.
Okay.
Are you still jealous of him?
No.
So you get into, you start UCB, and I think you were like kind of a hit right away. I felt like teachers liked you right away, and you were like, you got a good reaction from your peers from what I remember. I felt like you were in demand as much as a new student is going to be in the community.
I guess, yeah. I mean, it always feels daunting. It always feels like you're below. You can always point to people and say, how do I ever get to that position?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
There's always somebody in the next level.
I remember you being around and being in classes, and I remember talking to you here and there, but my first memory of seeing you in something was, I think... Delaney put you in Bobby Curious's one-man show.
Mm-hmm.
The
Me and Gethard were...
Yeah, you and Gethard had a small bit part in that show. And I teched that show, so I remember watching you in there.
Oh, yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah, we were like workers. We were like the blue collar workers of the show that like moved stuff around.
Yeah, that's right.
And I liked it because we took a lunch break in the middle of the show, so we got like sandwiches, like bologna sandwiches and chocolate milk that we ate on stage in the middle of the show. So I always liked that part.
We got to stop for a second. So we're back. We had to move. We were in a room, our usual room.
Are we recording again?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
We're recording again. And we have got bumped because all the rooms in the training center are taken.
Yeah, and because we run this whole operation just kind of like...
We run this with like the same organizational skill we apply to our real life.
Right.
Which is none.
Yeah.
So we got bumped for a one-on-one yoga session.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Okay.
More relevant.
So, you were...
One person gets some yoga lessons.
Yeah. One-on-one connection with a greater reality.
So now we're in the kitchen in the back of the training center. Invariably, a bunch of teachers are going to walk back here. So
yeah.
We could look forward to that.
It'll be great.
It's going to be really great.
A lot of walk-ons.
Oh, boy.
Right? So students listening to this will learn about walk-ons. That'll
be
good.
We're already like 20 minutes into this. We've gotten nowhere into John's life.
You were telling John a story about when you first remember seeing
him. I saw John in Armando Diaz Level 3 class. And like, you were hilarious. But I thought I was like very improv snobby. Like, you know, new to it. And like kind of... you know, really struck by all the things, and I was like, oh, this boy is not doing proper improv. Because
I wasn't.
Somebody would initiate something kind of like clumsy and not quite thought through because we were new and not good at it, and John would like sigh and put his arm around the person and be like, let me get this straight. Like, we used to do an impersonation of you before we met you, of you doing this move, putting your arm around people, sighing, and then looking out at the audience and saying, so you want me to get into an orchestra, an already playing orchestra, and pick up the cello, and it'd be so much funnier than whatever the other guy. It would just, everyone would laugh, just kind of like dominated the whole thing, and, you know, I didn't know what to make of it. I was like, well, it's funny, but he's being a dick.
Well, when people didn't know what they were doing, they would always try to initiate by, like, laying out some whole premise, like, you go over here and you do this, and I'll do that.
Yeah.
It's like, people didn't talk like that, but... I did, I had a very defensive style of play in the beginning, even throughout in my first team, we're ninjas, because I felt like everybody else on the team was an asshole, and I had to just sort of like be funny in spite of them and sort of fend for myself, which was not a good attitude. You know, I had to spend... You know, it took a lot of years to sort of get out of that habit then, because you can't play that way when you're playing actually with good people whom you respect.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to figure out how to actually play well.
What do you think helped you figure out how to do that? Was it conscious or was it just habitual?
It was conscious. I mean, you know, because, you know, when I started playing with people that were good... I found myself doing, you know, which I still do sometimes, doing moves that were, like, just sort of annoying, you know? It's funny if the audience goes, that one guy's funny and that other guy's, like, a total asshole, then it's funny. But if the audience is watching two funny people and one of them sort of, like, being a smartass and not fully engaging in the scene, then it's just sort of annoying. So at a certain point I thought, well, I should try to develop a skill other than this.
But I remember seeing you in the early days. You were a mixture of a wise ass who could be really funny at other people's expense, but also like a really good actor. Because I remember a couple weeks after the moment I'm talking about in Armando's class where you put your arm around some guy and restated his initiation to him in a sarcastic way. Like 2 weeks later, there was a matching characters exercise where somebody would initiate a big character, then you had to go up on stage and match it. This is you know, the class was in the theater. And Jessica St. Clair got up and initiated a cheerleader character. You might even remember this scene. And she was just like pretty straightforward, like cheerleader, like, come on, let's go, let's get him. And then you jumped up and totally committed and matched it, similar voice, like an impressively similar voice. And just like, yeah, go get him, let's get him. And then I think Jessica goes, oh my, Tommy, throw it, oh my God, he's so cute, or whatever the name of the quarterback was. And you... stopped. He goes, wait a minute, Stephanie, we made a promise to not use our bodies as currency. And I remember thinking like, oh my God, that is so funny. And then Jessica's like, oh my God, that's right. We're not going to like exploit ourselves to up our social status. And then like all the cheers got more self-aware and progressive. It was super hilarious.
Huh.
And I remember being blown away, being like, oh my God, that kid is... I was completely wrong about that kid. He is the best person in this class. He's like the funniest person.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
So you had no, before coming here, you didn't have any formal or any kind of acting training or anything?
Yeah, and then you could also do accents pretty well. I remember you did an Indian accent. Like, no one is trained to do accents in our coursework or anything, but right. Like, you would do a pretty accurate Indian accent.
The Indian's a pretty easy accent to do, though,
well,
right?
Nobody here can do any accent. I mean, that's not true.
Well, that's a broad generalization.
In classes.
Don't cut down the entire community because you can't do accents.
I can't do any. That's
you
can
do an Indian accent.
I don't think so.
Let me hear you do an Indian accent.
Hello. I don't I feel...
you almost got there.
No, I'm too
you got to jump off the dock into the lake.
Rudabudabudabu.
I'm an Indian. I blew out the microphone in a funny way. I don't know. So I feel like you've been here. So let's do just a quick overview of your whole improv career. I'm just going
to
say.
Well, to answer your question, okay. No, I didn't do anything. I didn't even do like plays in high school or anything.
Because you had a real swagger early. And it wasn't always a wise-ass swagger. It was like just a confident stage presence. I thought like ahead of your time on UCB.
Well, I was performing in the band. So I was performing for live audiences, but I don't know. I mean, some of it's a I was always nervous, you know?
Yeah.
I still get nervous, not for improv as much, but, you know, if I'm trying to do anything else, like a bit in a show or anything,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I still get nervous.
Really?
But you just have to, you know. I always knew that, like, it's not going to look good if somebody looks, like, nervous on stage. So
yeah.
Even if you're nervous, you have to make it. You have to make it seem like you're not nervous.
Sure.
You're someone who's...
You've missed every one of those. You're trying to throw bits of a stir into a garbage can that is technically not even really a garbage can, and I think you've missed every one. For those of you listening at home.
That's fair.
Okay.
Well, I think it's interesting for me to hear you talk about like things you tried to get better at, because I think basically you were... funny and confident right away, right from your first team, which was We're Ninjas, and have always been since. But I have noticed, as with a lot of people, over the course, like, you've gotten to be more selective in when you choose to, like, have fun and break things and when you kind of support and... You become a more, like, more integrity in your improv as years go. I mean, everybody goes through this, I think,
right.
as you do it more and more often. But because you are so delightfully joyful when you do have fun on stage, that it's really mm-hmm. striking when you commit super hard. That's why that
right.
cheerleading scene way back years ago struck me so much. Like, oh, this kid who, like, and you were literally a kid, like, made fun of everybody in class 2 weeks ago, is the best actor in the class. Or one of the best actors. I mean, so is Jessica. That both
right.
of that scene was really great. So, it's fun for me to hear you worry about getting better over the year. Or I don't know, whatever your internal development was.
Are you drawing a distinction between... You're drawing a distinction between aspects of my performing?
Yeah. Like, I'm curious, since you have such a devil-may-care attitude on stage, the idea that inwardly you are working on stuff is interesting to me. Because it looks effortless.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So do you ever work on stuff or think about it or like, oh, I wish I could be better at this or I wish I could do this more or just kind of take it as it came?
Well, there's a difference. I definitely feel with improv it's hard because I don't know what more there is to do on that skill.
Yeah.
I feel like at this point, once you've been doing it for, I've been doing it for almost 12 years now, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Once you've done it for that long and you've taken all the classes and stuff, it only sort of becomes about managing your own, you know. There's no skill to learn anymore, but I have gone through phases of, like, losing self-confidence. Like, I just started doing ASCAT regularly, like, maybe a year ago.
Uh-huh.
And that was, like... That's hard because it's like entering this whole other mini world with its own mini hierarchy.
Yeah.
And its own sort of way of doing things. And you're playing with like totally new people every week for at least the first bunch of it, you know.
Yeah.
But there's always the potential to be playing with
somebody new.
Somebody you know, of extreme status.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's like getting fucking doused with cold water a little bit. Because really? If you're used to being... If you're used to playing with the same people...
Right, you play with the Ruru for years and years, and then...
Yeah, on a popular team that can sort of do no wrong. I mean, even within Ruru, you go through your own sure. phases and cycles yeah, of right, like, right. God, I feel like I haven't, like, gotten out there fully.
But you're sort of in a comfortable team. You're familiar with those parameters, even. You know it'll come exactly. within a certain border. But then yeah. when you move on to something like ASCAT, for instance, the border kind of opens up. It's a yeah. whole new area of insecurity or security and things, a whole new set of things to look for.
Totally. And I went through, you know, a few months, at least, of feeling like, you know, nervous to do it. Like, I had to, was having to, like, prove that I was, which is ridiculous, you know, but, you know, prove that I was, like, worthy of doing it. Because ASCAT's one of those shows that you always sort of hold in your mind.
Yeah, if you're at the UCB community, ASCAT is the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I went through, and I'm not good when I'm in that mindset, you know, maybe nobody is.
Yeah.
But I feel like some people are like, I'm nervous. I feel like I have to prove myself. So
you reach down and you gain step up or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what you said.
Yeah.
Yeah. You dig deep and you pull it out.
Yeah.
I've done that, you know, a couple times in my life, but usually that adds up to me being at sort of half mast, you know?
Okay, yeah.
I sort of like, you know, just go cold a little bit.
Yeah, I can identify with that because I've gone through, I do ASCAT semi-regularly, and I've gone through the same yeah. thing of like, oh God, I don't belong here. I'm not, you know, I got to like really prove myself.
Yeah, and it's hard. And then it's in the context of being really funny in Ruru, which is a popular group that is basically static and I know the parameters of, and I'm one of the, you know, figureheads of, essentially, to go into a thing where, oh, Ari Vukitis. Oh, God. Just talking and talking. I'm still talking. Ari Vukitis. Just talking, talking. Oh, my God. Just laying it down, letting everybody all right, so know let's, all about it.
Yeah, so...
So then to go from that to something that is like... where you feel like... I'm not... Why can't I be myself out there? Why can't I do it how I do it, you know?
Yeah, the stakes are really high. It's yeah. a show that you have spent years revering. There's a big crowd that is really wanting the show to be successful and funny. There's people who are good enough that there's no excuse to not have a good show, but you don't know them or play with them regularly enough mm-hmm. to be super familiar with what's going to happen.
But I think what you said is accurate. It is ridiculous, and it's all completely self-generated. Like,
totally.
You do belong there. There's no reason why you shouldn't be there. Like, if you're on that stage, you're funny enough. It's not like nobody just wanders onto the ASCAT stage. Like, you're invited or you're asked to be there. So by default, you're good enough to be there. But then there's that thing that I know I go through, I think a lot of improvisers go through, a lot of artists in general, I think, go through yeah. of like, oh, fuck, like, somehow I'm going to fuck this up, or I need to, like, yeah. keep proving myself yeah. more. And I think what you're talking about is that thing, is you learn the skills, you learn how to do it, and then at a certain point it becomes about, like, harnessing your own ego and harnessing yeah. your own kind of, like, levels of self-confidence and belief in yourself.
Yeah.
And
because if you're a respected person in this improv world, you can really let it go to your head. I mean, people really sort of like, there are a few areas of the entertainment industry that have this clear a hierarchy, you know?
Yeah.
This small, it's like a few hundred people with just crystal clear hierarchy, you know?
Right. You are in classes but not approved for advanced classes. You're in advanced classes but not on a performance team. You're on a Herald team but not on the weekend team. You're on a weekend team but not this weekend team. You're on a weekend team but you don't play for ASCAT.
Yeah.
There are different combinations of that.
Yeah.
Or you're a teacher or you're not a teacher, or like you're a coach or not a coach. There's status, explicit status everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot
so
of
your
labels.
Ego, yeah. If you're high status, I mean, it's hard not to let that go to your head. So then it's like a big blow when you don't feel confident.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me to hear you even talk about not being confident. Like, I took classes with you. We were in a practice group on a Herald team for however many years, 4 years, something like that, mm-hmm. 5 years almost. And I never remember you seeming unconfident.
It is interesting.
But I
yeah.
believe you. I don't disagree with you. But it's interesting
it's
to hear.
Yeah,
like some people, you can see it.
Yeah.
You can see them get nervous or lose.
I've never seen that from
yeah.
you. You do like Will said.
Neil Casey's another one. There's some people like you just don't. I've seen
yeah.
other people kind of turtle up and
mm-hmm.
hit the back line when they're not feeling it.
I think that is the mark.
I have
of...
done that. I mean, I've done. If I well, especially in like the marathon late night shows,
yeah.
If I'm like really high,
yeah.
I've done shows where I just didn't say anything,
yeah.
And in my mind, I was like, you gotta say something. You have to speak at some point, right? I mean, at this point, everybody's staring at you and going, "Why is he standing there not speaking?" And it's horrible.
Sure.
But yeah, and I guess in recent years, I've started thinking about. I mean, I love improv and I love this community, but I feel like the focus, being so focused on it, and I feel like I've sort of milked it for everything, you
yeah.
know? But then I haven't, like, really written as much as I should have, or, you know, gone out and sort of excelled in other tangible areas, you know? Because improv is very intangible.
Yeah,
it takes
yeah.
a long time to get recognized as, you know, if you write, you can write one good fucking screenplay and
yeah.
then be at the top of the industry, you know, if you're
yeah.
lucky, obviously that's
right,
it.
Right.
It's possible. You have to do a billion fucking good improv shows before anybody recognizes you as a good improviser
yeah.
because
yeah.
there's no way of.
There's no record of it.
Right.
It's
before
all
you
word
even
of mouth.
Start to get that, like, oh, that guy's really good. Let's, you know, ask him to be in a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a tricky kind of false brass ring, you know, to reach for the top of whatever. We've talked about this on this podcast
yeah.
before, but there's no reaching for the top of this mountain. You can do that,
yeah.
but it's like if you
diminishing returns.
If you expect this community to constantly fulfill your expectations, you're going to get disappointed because
yeah.
either you're not going to get those expectations or somebody else is going to come along and get them, and then you're going to be lost thinking, like, what the fuck? Why is that not me?
Or you get it and it's not what you thought it was.
Yeah.
It doesn't, like, deliver the thing you thought.
It's like having a city job in a lot of ways. Like being a garbage man. You just have to, like, be there for, like, 20 years before they, like, give you the good shift.
Sometimes,
and,
yeah.
Let's talk about... I'd like to talk about you and Curtis because
oh, yeah.
so long, like, you... you two together were like a fixture at the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Both individually as performers, but together, like, you, I mean, you guys called yourself the Cowboy and John for some
yeah.
time, and then it was just Curtis
never
and Gambling.
He always wanted to change that.
Oh, was that your idea?
Like, well, no, we were, I think we came up with it, like, jogging on treadmills at Crunch.
See,
we were on
just,
one of our workouts.
yeah.
Like that
That's
scene.
Not something I would have ever pictured.
How did you meet Curtis, and how did it come to be that you guys decided to work together? What was that like?
We just met at the theater. Like, I guess I saw him. He used to host Herald Night
right.
at 161. So we just saw each other around a little bit. He was ahead of us by one class, I think.
Yeah.
And then we just started talking about, like, video games and shit. I think back then it was, like, PlayStation 2 versus the Xbox. That'll show you how long ago that was. they were, like, just coming out. And we hit it off. We started hanging out and just, like, watching movies and shit. He was living with his friend from high school, Brett Mayen. And I just started basically, like, I was still at my mom's house.
In New York City.
Yeah. And I just started, like, staying at their house. And then eventually I was just like sleeping on the couch every single night, and Curtis's roommate, who became a friend of mine, at a certain point was like, he can't like sleep here all the time. He's gotta like start paying rent, or like he can't like be in the living room. So at that point, I started sleeping in Curtis's bed with him.
Really?
Yeah. Just for like a couple weeks.
Even one night is
hilarious. Yeah.
I'm getting coffee.
Right. And then, ooh, using the Keurig.
Yep.
And then Brett moved out, and I moved in, and Curtis's brother moved in.
What year is this? Did you imagine? This is like 90...
This was...
2001, I bet.
Yep, 2001 or 2002. Okay. I remember, I was there for 9/11, but I don't think I was sleeping on the couch at that point.
Okay.
Because Curtis came out of his room and said a plane just hit the World Trade Center, and I said something like, oh, what a surprise, and then I went back to sleep. And then the second one hit, and I was like, all right, let's turn the TV on. And then we lived together for like 7 or so years. Me... You and Curtis were... and Curtis's brother.
Okay.
You guys were great. I mean, I know you still, I'm not, I don't mean to speak of it totally in the past tense, but at that time it was like, oh yeah, those two are great. And you two definitely fit together. Like, it, that was the birth of what is now Ruru, like the sensibility between you two. Not that it's, Ruru is more than that and there's other things to it, but that is the core
seed,
of it.
Yeah.
That, the two of you became like the center of Monkey Dick in a lot of ways, and then Ruru even more. And your sketch shows and stuff. And it's a real, like, sci-fi, cinephile, media, obsessed, sarcastic, kind of surreal, like, real, like, good British sketch comedy mentality was with you guys. Like, you, I remember being struck by, because we were all on a team together, how smart you guys were. Smart and lowbrow. Like, lowbrow, wise-ass, sometimes a mess of human beings just coming in, like, just could not get their shit together, didn't pay dues for rehearsal, wouldn't, you, whatever, like...
What do you mean, didn't pay dues?
Well, Curtis did that for a while, but...
I always paid.
You always paid, that's right. but just people who carried around the air of sort of, like, like, the Animal House or something, like, the deliberately reckless, that was the energy... But then, like, a real real specific writing, really, like, clear comedic ideas, like, I mean, you guys were a force at 161 already, and then even more when we moved over to 26th Street, I think.
You guys' first show together was the, was that the zombie show?
No, Big Heist was
the first show.
Big Heist is a great sketch show. It definitely...
When was that?
Oh, that was at 161.
That was at 161.
Was that 2001 or 2002, or... Why do I think
that was
2002? It wouldn't be 2001.
Okay, that's why I don't remember.
Might be 2003. Where was it in relation to Joe
and Neil's show?
When did 161
close? It was before Joe and Neil's show.
October of...
Joe and Neil's first show was at Chelsea Playhouse, wasn't it?
Oh, that's right. October of
2002, 2003?
Something like that. We submitted... The show was called The Big Heist. We submitted it to Kevin Mullaney as, like... It's like an Abbott and Costello type of, like... you know, farcical comedy duo show.
Yeah.
And then we just wrote a completely different show that had nothing to do with
the show opened with two people writing a sketch show at the last minute. That was the opening segment of the show, from what I remember.
Yeah.
And the framework of the show was a green orb floated from the sky and kept introducing the next sketch.
Yeah, the green orb was it was based on the green orb from the heavy metal movie. That basically traveled around, like, absorbing people's life force and, like, learning their story. It was, like, a storyteller, or it absorbs stories or something. Anyway, our green orb was there to, like, learn all about comedy and, like, absorb and kill comedians. so it would come down. It came down and said it wanted to absorb us. And then each sketch, before it absorbed us, it was going to show us sketches or comedy that it had learned from around the cosmos. So each sketch was like a story that it told. And then at the end of the show, we had to tell it, you know, because the beginning of the show was we were writing the show at the last minute and it wasn't done. So at the end we tell the Orb, well, you know, we waited till the last minute. We haven't actually written the show. And the Orb's like, what?
Yeah.
There's no show. So it's disappointed. It has nothing to absorb. And then I think a second orb drops down,
and they themselves are a mismatched pair, the same way that every sketch so far had featured a mismatched pair.
Yeah,
maybe the last line of the show is, I'm a mismatched pair, yeah. I'm a mismatched pair of orbs, or something like that.
Yeah, the second orb drops down and starts nagging it, and it's like, so then the orb itself has a comic foil.
It was a really hilarious show. Well, you guys are both great in it. And, but right after that, the theater got shut down.
The theater got shut down. I remember the day the theater got shut down, we were supposed to do a bit in Pile Driver, right? That was the wrestling show then?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was on Friday. The theater got shut down on a Tuesday, so maybe that week.
I don't think it was when Pile Driver had a regular show. It was like I forget what it was.
Okay.
But there was something like we had some bit to prepare. I think it was for Pile Driver. And we hadn't done it. It was like 2 hours before the show. We hadn't written or prepared anything. We had no costumes or anything. We were like in a panic. Whenever we had to do anything, we turned into this horrible panic. We got a call from Billy that the theater had been shut down.
Oh,
we were
God.
So relieved. We were like, yo, the theater shut down! We were like, oh, God! Our night, we have a whole night ahead of us to do whatever we want. We didn't realize then, of course, that the theater would be permanently shut down. But that was like one of those moments. We had to do this show one time, just a stupid like variety show at like Rafifi or something. It was one of Derek Gordon's shows. You remember Derek Gordon?
Yes, I do.
Did the ECNY. He created the ECNY Awards.
Oh. Yes.
I don't know if he gets any credit for that anymore. And we just had nothing. We had no... Because we never... For whatever reason, we never, like, perfected bits to do. We tried to do, like, a different thing every time out.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't like you do something and it's like, oh, let's polish that for another time.
Yeah. I mean, we had like some sketches that we would do over and over again, but then we always felt like we should try to, for I guess whatever reason, like a variety shows felt like it should be a different thing. So I don't know, but we hadn't come up with anything, and we had to go do this show. So Curtis went. We both went down to Rafifi. We walked down there, and Curtis went in, and I hid like two blocks away around a corner. And Curtis went in and told him that I had, like, booked a commercial at the last minute and was, like, shooting and, like, maybe I would make it. And he said, like, okay, well, let's just wait and see if he makes it. So Curtis had to sit there with him waiting in Rafifi while I was hiding around the corner in the cold for, like, 45 minutes.
Oh, my God.
And then finally Curtis came back and he's like, okay, we're good. Let's go. Let's get out of here. It's both the worst. It's like the most horrible feeling to like be unprepared.
Yeah.
But then for whatever reason, I've always gotten such satisfaction out of like getting out of those moments.
Yeah, working your way out of those jams.
Feeling no shame for like the lying and right. The unpreparedness.
Not a thing of like, oh my God, we really gotta next time get our shit together and prepare something.
The feeling of relief was so intense and amazing.
You want to skip forward ahead to Gemberling?
Yeah, let's start with the Channel 102 show, Gemberling. So Tony Carnevale gets the... So Channel 101 is happening in L.A. They're doing five-minute television episodes under the guidance of Dan Harmon and Rob Schraub. And this is before YouTube, and internet videos still have a novelty to them. And they're all way too long, and 5 minutes is actually a short time for a video at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you're in the know comedy-wise, do you like Channel 101? Like, you're obsessed with the website.
We loved it.
You guys were. And it wasn't the thing that everybody knew about, but most people had some knowledge of it. And some people were super
into
it.
And in L.A., they probably knew about it more than in New York.
Yeah, it was an L.A. thing more than a New York thing. And then Tony Carnevale guy who's in the community wanted to start his own New York branch of it, emailed Dan Harmon, and Dan Harmon, to everybody's surprise, said, yeah, just go ahead and do it. Start your branch of Channel 101. Remember, he gave me the password to the server so I could copy the code for the site, which I didn't understand enough to be able to copy. But he just handed me the password to it. And so we started it. We called it Channel 102. I think that was Harmon's suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
And which was just going to be a monthly competition where people would bring five-minute television episodes. You show them to an audience. The audience votes in their favorite, and that gets renewed to make another episode the next month. And most of these were lo-fi, not that good. A couple of them were good.
Mm-hmm.
Yours was one of the best. Fun Squad.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. Funny.
I made that the day after shooting yours.
Mm-hmm.
But you guys got... And Fun Squad was very slapdash, deliberately, and thrown together. Most of the shows were... You know, the whole point of Channel 101 was, like, make stuff. Like, do not get fussy about... Don't be a perfectionist. Get it done. Have fun. Enjoy it. There is no tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys... You guys got very ambitious. You made it like a real high quality show.
We were that way about everything. I mean, all of our sketch shows required. I mean, even like one off bits that we did, sketch shows. For whatever reason, we only thought it was funny, or the stuff that we thought was funniest involved like a massive amount of props and like set pieces and things that, like, you know, had to be built and brought together and hauled somewhere. So everything, and we were, every time we did something, we were like, okay, simple. Let's just do it, like, very simple. For whatever reason, I don't know if it was like, you know, maybe part of it was, like, fear-based, like, oh, if there's, like, a million, like, props and things happening, maybe... The dialogue doesn't have to be as funny or stuff. Not that I think our dialogue wasn't funny, but, you know, I felt like, certainly in my mind, it felt like you don't have to worry as much about the writing of it if you've got, like, a million props and things going on.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But yes. So the show was called Gimberling. It was inspired by the movie Tron, roughly, right?
Yeah, which I actually hate. I don't like the movie Tron at all. I think it's really boring and... stupid. And
okay.
I think the visual effects are sickening.
So how did the idea come about? What was the original impetus for the idea of Gimberling?
The original impetus was we bought a camera. We said if we spend $5,000 on what was then a pretty good prosumer camera, we'll have to make something. So we bought a camera and a green screen and a boom mic, and then Curtis just, you know, said one day, what if we make a thing with the green screen where, you know, it's in the internet and you're a programmer that gets sucked into the internet. And he'd already done the Chains character in Doc and Chains, so that was we liked.
That was a sketch from your How to Live Comfortably show originally.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that we thought of as sort of like part of our universe. So, we started filming it for... And we wanted to do something for the first premiere Channel 102 screening.
Right. So this was you... It was mostly green screen, but the character begins in an office. So you filmed this whole thing in Rob Lathan's office. Rob Lathan, teammate.
Yeah.
I just bring it up because I think it's so funny that every weekend... Not every weekend, but like once a month... For 8 months, there'd be some weekend in Rob's office where a whole film crew came in and did an episode, right?
Yeah.
Am I remembering that
we
right?
We filmed the office location in his office, and the green screen we nailed into somebody's wall in his office.
Yeah.
And they must have come in every Monday morning and just, like, smelled this, because we wore, like, unitards in it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is basically like putting a sausage in a sweaty sausage casing.
Yeah.
So it must have just smelled like fucking sweat and balls and farts and pizza and stuff.
Who's the guy that directed that? The guy from college?
Alan Harris.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you got like a director, a guy with video experience. You had this really good camera. You had good post effects. I think you learned how to do the post effects.
I learned how to do After Effects, and I learned how to build 3D sets in Maya, which is a 3D animation, not 3D, but, you know, CGI animation program.
Wow, you learned how to do all that stuff for...
Yeah, yeah, I didn't know how to actually, like, animate it. Also, my computer couldn't handle actually animating it, but I could build... We used stock backgrounds for the first few episodes, and then we started to run out of interesting stock backgrounds, so I learned how to, like, do basic 3D texture mapping stuff.
You got great people to be in all the episodes. Cordry was in episode 2, Hubel was in 1, Julie Klausner's in that show. You got, like, the best. Mm-hmm. Victor Vernado was in episode 2, I think. And I'm gonna forget if I start to keep... Oh, and Katie Dippold, Neil Casey were running characters. All Gelman. Great people. Gelman. I know we're gonna... I'll forget.
Paul Scheer.
Right, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was like a phenomenon. Like, it was the engine of Channel 102 for that first year. Like, it was the big show every month, I felt. And there were other things, but there were other shows that were good. 102 itself was kind of a cool thing that was happening. But Gimberling was definitely, like, the star.
It was definitely grueling. I mean, we didn't do anything else for that period. We basically focused all our efforts. I mean, we would write the script in, like, a couple days, and then film it in 2 or 3 days, and then immediately start editing it. And then as soon as it was edited, I would work on the effects and everything for it. And then it was usually finished like a half an hour before the show. And then after the show, it would usually be a week or two of just sort of like recuperating time.
Okay, yeah.
Our manager at the time was sort of like, "What the fuck are you doing? You're just working on this like one thing."
Yeah.
This like weird like web show, like.
Yeah, because 102 had no presence.
Yeah.
Except for its association with 101, which was tenuous.
I feel like that's always the story with things that eventually develop some kind of success. Is you always hear, "Our manager or my manager was saying, why the fuck are you doing this? Why the fuck are you working on this thing?" And it. Yeah. Is then a thing that becomes...
But it was great. Like, the audience loved it.
That's what I mean.
It was
like,
clearly... I mean, there was evidence as they went along that this was a good thing. They weren't...
Oh, yeah. No, that's what I mean. It always seems like the managers at the time don't understand, like...
And also, but we didn't know... It was great for 102. Yeah. I didn't have a sense that it was necessarily great beyond 102. Because the effects weren't good. They were just good... In the context of something that had been done in a month.
Yeah.
So it was very hard to gauge. We just knew
that
it was like fun to do.
An earlier time for comedy videos, too. Like, the standard for everything. Like, College Humor wasn't doing videos then, or if they were, they weren't like these big high-production originals.
Yeah.
This is before Derek Comedy. There wasn't, like, a rich tradition of web comedy videos that looked good. It was a cut-up.
But there was the idea, because there hadn't been a standard set for... videos on the web, my thinking was like, well, if you're making a video on for anything, it should like look as good as anything.
As the movies
or
something.
Yeah. Yeah, we never tried to make it look bad. We were trying to make it look as good as possible.
Well, I guess that's the big juxtaposition of you and Curtis. I'm gonna oversimplify, like, from the outside, is like, on one aspect, there are these guys who can't get their shit together enough to come up with an idea for a bit show, and Gimberling's hiding for an hour outside to avoid the awkwardness of this bit, which is, like, hilarious and kind of juvenile and fun. But then there's these guys who bust ass and make a TV-quality thing with no money, if they're just through pure manpower. Like, you learned After Effects, and, you know, and you guys bought this camera, and Curtis got obsessed with, like, reading about cameras, and, like, it was great. It was really fun to watch happen. It was exciting. When you guys did the finale, you did a finale deliberately over the 5-minute time limit, which would disqualify you, which was a way of self-canceling.
Yeah.
It was like an event. Like, everybody came to the theater. I'm sure Eric Appel, who, you know, now is director in L.A. and had, you know, has been a big guy at Funny or Die, was definitely there, super excited to see it. Like, it was, everybody went to see that finale.
Mm-hmm.
It was really funny and great. Wasn't it like an 18-minute finish?
Yeah, it was
like
18 minutes long.
Yeah.
it's like a season finale. It's like a 2-hour season finale.
Yeah. And then, and those are all on YouTube. You can find them if you Google them.
Are they on YouTube now?
They get taken down occasionally, but they're always put back. You can find them.
Because you guys had to take a lot of that. I know it all came down off of the 102 site when you guys got the...
It's not on the 102 site anymore.
Adult Swim
show, right?
Yeah, I don't even know if they would care, though. I bet you could put it back up on there. I don't even know if they would care.
I used to do it every 6 months anyway. I would put them back and just wait for someone to ask me to take them down again.
Did they ask you?
You always asked me.
Oh. Hey, put them back up.
Yeah, okay.
And what's the time frame between the show ending on 102 and things starting to get moving with the... Like, when did the...
It became an Adult Swim show called Fat Guy Stuck on the Internet.
Yeah, and when did people start sniffing around? Or when did you guys start saying, like, we should make a bigger thing out of this?
We never... Well, we... When we were done at Channel 102 and we did all our episodes, I edited together a, like, little couple-minute trailer. And we started making DVDs that had all the episodes in the trailer. And you know, they were, like, printer... paper covered DVDs, but it looked, you know, it looked as nice as we could make it look.
We got one here in the training center.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the bookshelf.
Come on, check it out. So we did that and we went out to LA and, like, you know, did a couple pitch meetings and showed it a couple places, and I think it was like maybe the spring of that next year. One of our agents gave it to one of the Adult Swim guys who was in town, and he watched it and took a meeting with us, and then they made a pilot. We never pitched it to Adult Swim. They just watched it. We had a meeting at, like, a vodka bar. They had, like, flavor vodkas and stuff. And, then they called us a couple weeks later and said they wanted to do a pilot.
So you did how many episodes?
We ended up doing 10 episodes.
Of 15-minute shows, and I think it's awesome. Yeah. I love the 102 show, and there are certain charms of the things that happened when you were under time pressures, a looseness that was fun. But the Adult Swim show to me is like masterpiece. It's like as good as Mighty Boosh or any of these like weird, surreal shows in England, because it's really funny, densely... organized,
yeah,
hits the Joseph Campbell outline that you got, that at least Curtis was obsessed with at that time, because of Harmon's influence, but it fulfilled it. And a lot of the episodes are named after Joseph Campbell things, I think,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
Joseph Campbell, the
hero of a thousand
faces, story structure, yeah, dude,
comparative mythologist,
yeah.
And they also, each one of them has each episode is different homages to different.
Genres.
Sci-fi or fantasy things or genres.
It's very, like, spaced in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a Dark Tower episode.
Yeah. Right, the Dark Tower one, the zombie one.
Mm-hmm.
The Maze Master is my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Labyrinth.
Yeah. But every episode, I think, is really great.
Yeah.
And you did find... It was interesting to watch it evolve, because I felt like a couple episodes in, there were selective moments of, like, looseness and kind of playfulness that had been in the internet series.
Yeah. Like, I wish we'd captured that more in
I think you did. I think it just took a couple episodes to...
Yeah.
Get a sense over how to get it in there.
Yeah.
Like, there's that part where you're playing the evil villain and... Is it Liz Kukowski's there and you're arguing over who gets to say a certain phrase? You don't say that. I say that. It's something like, "Who boy? I say who boy."
Oh, yeah.
"You don't say who boy." And it's like a long pause. She's like, "I say it sometimes." "No, you don't." It's like this. I don't remember it exactly, but it was really funny.
Yeah.
And like this kind of slow moment in the middle of a real densely packed sci-fi show.
Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah, we figured out how to do... We were limited improv-wise because it was so technically demanding. We were shooting against a green screen.
And this is directed by
Ryan McFall.
Yeah. You're shooting in a Bushwick? You had a studio in Bushwick you did all this in?
Mm-hmm. And the Nut Roaster studio. So really, you can only shoot with one camera, you know? And a lot of the focus was going into making the shots technically able to, you know, do the effects that they needed to do. And really what works best for improv and how they shoot a lot of comedy movies and shows these days is you'll have more than one camera, you know, two or three cameras going, so that if you hit good improv, you have
it from both sides. Yeah,
exactly. So it was tough doing improv because if you don't figure out what you want to do, if you're only using one camera, if you don't figure out what you want to do when you're getting that first shot, you might only have it from one close-up or one, you know, master shot. So, and it's sort of boring to watch a scene take place or a run of dialogue take place in just one shot.
Mm-hmm.
So that was tough, but we sort of figured out, like, okay, well, we can't purely sort of go totally off the cuff, but if we want to fuck around, we need to figure it out early and then put it in all the shots.
Right. Well, it's a great, it's a really great show, and anybody who's a fan of Ruru, or just good, anybody likes the Mighty Boosh and Snuffbox
just good
and all,
TV.
Yeah, but a, particular, like, surreal comedy, especially. I'm thinking of the those British... I'm sure you guys were thinking of the British shows, I think.
Oh, totally.
I feel like you guys
introduced... Big fans of Mighty Boosh and...
Chris Norris is a Brass Eye.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
Chris Morris.
Yeah. Sorry, I'll edit that out. or Jam, was that his show, too? Or
Jam was his show, too. He did Jam, Brass Eye. He did a show called Nathan Barley.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, Look Around You.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is a great show.
Yeah.
He didn't do Look Around You, but
that's a show
great
that
show.
Influenced.
Yeah.
And it's kind of that generation of weird, surreal, good British stuff.
Right.
Well, I feel like it. A lot of people saw that show, but not enough people saw it. I feel like they should dig it up.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we have a copy of it here. I hope we do. We should get it.
We have a copy of Gambling. That's for.
I know we have the 102 episodes. I don't know if we have the Adult Swim stuff. We should get it somehow.
We'll look into it.
Okay.
That would just have to be a... I guess I would just have to burn you a DVD.
Yeah, well, we should make that
happen.
Because
they never released DVDs.
Oh, they never released DVDs of the show?
Someone's phone is on.
Not mine.
Not mine.
Okay.
I put it on silent.
So you also did... more recently, you did Besser's show for a little while. The show Will Get You High. You went out to LA to do that.
I went out last year. Was it last year? Yeah, it must have been.
Yeah, it was last year.
Last, like, May or April or something to do... He sold a pilot to Comedy Central that was a sketch show. It was, like, combination, like, sketch, live show, and sort of prank sketches that was, I guess, to be the new sort of UCB's new crop of talent type of thing. And they aired it as a special, but didn't get picked up.
Yeah.
But it was fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of funny stuff in there.
Great cast.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Besser liked you real early. Besser always... Besser and Delaney, back in the early days, would be the guys who kind of, like, would pick out, I feel like, the people who were the rising stars and pay attention to them a lot. I feel like Besser liked you. I feel like he was charmed.
Maybe. I couldn't... I could never tell where I stood. I guess I was in Bad Mayor Bad, one of his old shows.
Yeah.
But just as, like, a one-line
townsperson. Sure, yeah. I want to talk about Ruru.
Yeah.
I want to talk about what's special about Ruru and what's maybe, I don't know, like favorite moments or favorite shows you've had. Or like, Ruru's one of the best teams ever been to the theater. And it's a lot of people's favorites. What's it like on the, you've been there the whole time.
This is a almost useless anecdote, but the first, when I first came back to the theater, I think it was 2005, I came to the Marathon. That was like the first thing that I came to, and I remember I saw you guys show, and I was sitting in, like, the second row, and you had this line that I don't remember what the context of it was, but it was so funny, and it just blew the audience away. Like, out of nowhere, I don't even remember it enough to set it up, but you had just pointed out, like, how two of the people in the cast were wearing the exact same watch, and you just came off the back line and were like, is it because you two are wearing the same watch? Oops, sorry.
That is ridiculous.
And, like, the audience just exploded. It was so hilarious.
I've had a few good, you guys both are wearing the same type of clothing moments.
Is that your thing? Is that a thing of yours?
Hey, look. If it's out there, it's all about truth. It's all about what's happening.
The truth that they're wearing the same watch? That was the truth you were getting?
Well, it is a strength of yours is to be able to, like, you're very good at picking up details both externally and, like, in people's logic. You know, you're very good at calling out people on their logic or on their bullshit or on, like, specific things about them. Your powers of observation are very strong, I guess, is the concise way to say that.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
So that was at 161, you said?
No, that was at the current theater.
Yeah. You're asking, what's it like?
Let's talk about Ruru. Like, what are your either favorite Ruru shows or what makes Ruru work? Like, what's good about Ruru from the inside? What do you think makes it work?
I think we all always liked each other, you know? I think we prized very highly the idea that everybody should like each other and just have fun playing with each other. I think, you know, we sort of, Curtis and I sort of really bristled early at the idea of, like, teams that were being put together, you know? I mean, I think we all did. I think everybody on Monkey Dick, to a certain extent, we did Monkey Dick as a practice group before it became a team.
Yeah.
And we liked that better than whatever teams we were on, you know? Right. I certainly always resented the idea that, like, some Herald Council is going to put me on a team randomly with people that, you know, they don't know if I like playing with them, you know?
Right, or if they don't play well with them, yeah.
Yeah. And it was always very difficult to put your own stuff together. You know, they always sort of discouraged it and gave you the idea that, like, we know best and, you know. But it's like, would you be in a band, you know? Would you, like, do music with people randomly? Or would you be in a group with people that you like playing with and chose to play with, you know? And sure, maybe at a certain point starting out, you don't maybe have the scope of knowledge to, like, fully make those choices properly. But it felt like such a long haul, you know. And then you had those teams like Supper Time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which was like a team comprised only of people that they couldn't find places for on other teams. So it's like, what's the fucking point of, like, being like, well, none of these people worked on other teams, so let's put them all together.
Yeah.
And maybe that'll work. It's like, it seemed like such a hopeless process.
So Ruru was responding to that in some fashion.
Well, Monkey Dick was responding to that.
Yeah.
And then Ruru maybe...
The core of Monkey Dick picked itself.
The core of Monkey Dick picked itself, and then the sort of powers that be Herald Council sort of took it from there, you know?
Yeah.
And Ruru's maybe a little bit more of a purer form in the sense that we've always just picked our own members.
Yeah.
You know? Which,
So you're looking for people who get along, there's harmony, that sounds like it's a priority.
I mean, you just have a sense, you know, if you take out of the equation that anybody else is going to pick who's on the group except for the group themselves, you know, then I think that's a big step, you know? Mm-hmm. If you say, we enjoy playing with this person, we work well with them, and we like them, therefore, that should be the only criteria for putting them on a team, I think that's the only way to do it, you know?
It's certainly a good way to ensure chemistry and ensure the kind of respect that you're talking about and the kind of, like, well, we already know that we like this person.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, everybody's got to be talented, but it just never made sense to do it any other way, you know?
Do you remember any breakthrough Ruru shows early? Like, shows were like, oh yeah, this is good, or this show's really good, or this is like a thing that's working.
Well, the first shows we did were 3-on-3. I mean, our first couple shows were, like, amazing. It was just me, Curtis, and Neil in 3-on-3 tournament. We had a show in the marathon at, like, 5 in the morning, me, Curtis, Neil, and Gelman, that was super fun. Because our shows used to be, like, really high-paced, really aggressive, sort of fast, flash-fried improv. and then it sort of, like, slowed down and I think gained more different dynamics over the years. But we had, yeah, that one show at like 5 in the morning, we all really loved. We did a scene where we were all Buffalo Bill.
Ha!
I don't think we ever said Buffalo Bill, yeah. But we were all that, like, you know how he kidnaps the girl by, like, trying to get, he gets her to, like, he's got, like, a broken arm.
Yeah.
He's like, can you help me put this, I need help putting this couch in my van.
Yeah.
And she, like, gets in the van, he closes the doors and locks her in the van. So we were all Buffalo Bill, all trying to get everybody else to help them put their couch in their van. And that, we had a lot of fun with that.
Now, were you guys doing the project at this point? Remember Terry Jennings, the project?
Yeah.
There was a Ruru team in the project.
That was after. Right. I think the 3&3 team came first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or actually, it wasn't even the, it was a different theaters. It was actually above Clepton. It was beneath the theater on Bond Street. There was a theater downstairs on Bond Street. They named after an actor, like the Gene Frankel Theater or something, and then the basement was...
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't matter. But Terry Jin's show, the project, where he picked captains and they picked a team.
Mm-hmm.
He asked Curtis to put together a team, and Curtis put together a version of Ruru for that. I think that was after the 3-on-3 tournament.
Yeah, I mean, that was when Ruru was already...
Your phone's making interference on the mic.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, you've put it in airplane mode.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Ruru was already an entity. I don't remember that exactly, but I'm sure that we were basically just like, let's do a Ruru show.
Yeah, it was you and Curtis. It was a little different. It was you and Curtis and Neil and Joe and Gelman and Will Nuns.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was, and, yeah, those shows were really funny, too.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah. Yeah, that was sort of like proto-Ruru.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then you guys start doing your own shows at the theater. You start doing... Eventually, you guys start doing, you know, weekend shows.
We had to run 4 Fast, 4 Furious, which was like a once-a-week show. And then when Monkey Dick was on its way out, Owen Burke, who was the artistic director at the time, did a cold swap.
Monkey Dick for Ruru, yeah.
Yeah.
The Friday at 11 spot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Monkey Dick, I guess it sort of stalled out. And, who the fuck is that? The fuck is that? It's Art, it's Vakitas again.
Is it?
Kita's talking, just encouraging somebody.
He's encouraging loud chatter.
I mean, he knows what's happening in here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're in a public luncheonette area. We're allowed to do podcasts.
Well.
Yeah, Monkey Dick was stalling out. We were 5 years old at that time and had gone through a million overhauls.
Somehow we could never maintain an audience.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this about Ruru. Do you... It's kind of a weird question, probably, but do you, like, Ruru's one of the most celebrated teams at the theater right now, and do you kind of feel that you guys are, like, does it feel different, like, being on this team that kind of goes out there and is, like, goes on these huge, massive cage match runs, and, you know, is, like, being loved by the theater?
Well, the last cage match one, we lost, like, the second time
out. That's true, but for the most part.
We definitely felt it when we were on that huge cage match run. But then it's the kind of thing where, like, yeah, I mean, and it felt great. But then it's the kind of thing where as soon as you have a run of not-so-great shows or a cage match that you lose immediately, you know, you go, okay, well, this is, you know, a cyclical world, you know. There's no...
Right.
There's nothing to being hailed as a great group except that some people think you're a great group. You know, it doesn't guarantee anything.
It's
worth
gone
any money
when the show's over. Yeah.
But you know, it's a.
There's got to be something more to it though, because like, look how much energy you've put into it over the years, and you've gone back to it and protected it, and taking care. I mean, I hear everything you're saying on this. I mean, I think that and more.
Oh no, so, it's enormously satisfying.
Those are separate things. I think like you have to devote yourself to it with full kind of integrity and commitment, but you also can't get caught in the trappings of like this is the most important thing that there is.
Yeah. Well, it's also tempered by what I was talking about earlier, which is like I put so much into this group, possibly at the expense of, you know, other skills and other sort of tangible things that I feel like I need to now start focusing on more. So,
right. Yeah.
But no, it's amazing. I said this a few months ago in a different podcast, but I felt like you start out in improv and you you feel like, oh God, I want to be on that stage with those people and like live these moments that they're doing, and then it's such a long road to actually get there. For years, you feel like sort of crestfallen because you're having fun, but you're not doing it at the level that you want to be doing it at.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do it for long enough, and you sort of hit a point where you go, wow, now I am at the place that I wanted to be at 10 years ago, 12 right. years ago. And I can recognize that, and that's definitely satisfying.
Sure. And now it's, you know, where else to go from here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me recount a couple of my favorite John Gimbeling scenes ever.
Please.
In the early days.
Okay.
We're Ninjas, first show. Do you remember the Old Man Liver?
Mm-hmm.
Suggestion was Old Man River.
Uh-huh.
Second group game, nobody is stepping out because the show, I think, wasn't going that well. People were getting tentative. Gimbeling steps out alone and goes, Old Man Liver... Old Man Liver, I'm the greatest parody songwriter in history. And then they
and nobody else stepped out, right?
No one stepped out for a while. And then, like, the rest of it was the enormous... And then they eventually played out the enormous success of this great parody author who had written Old Man Liver. Then the other Old War Ninja scene that my brother
this
and I used
to... Is one of your favorite moments?
Yeah. Because it was like... No, it was like the arrival of this, like... this person who was going to end up being, like, a big player at the theater.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we knew you. We knew you from classes, so yeah. We were excited to see you on a Herald
team. And Monkey
team.
Dick.
Yeah.
We were doing the practice
Monkey Dick
group.
Was already
yeah.
full in full force, yeah. So, like, it was like, oh, we know this guy's great. Here is everyone going to find out how great this guy is. And then another one was another group game you started was, everybody get in here. We're going to have the craziest business meeting ever. Now let's go down the line and each say something that's increasingly funny. I think you, like, dictated the outline of a terrible group game. That was so great. So funny. I don't know. I like those two.
That's it?
I can keep going.
That's all right.
I like... I've talked about this before in a Ruru project show where... you and Gelman were doing a scene. Gelman had been some misbehaving student, and they cut to you as an authority figure punishing him, and Gelman called you Superintendent Shithead. Sorry, Superintendent Shithead. And you go, ah, that's not how it's pronounced. It's Superintendent Shithead. And then Gelman goes, how'd you get that name? And they did like a swinging door to explain he got that name, and you came back and you were like, so that was a fairly straightforward explanation of how I got it. Like making fun of the uselessness of the swinging door.
Right.
But I thought like that was like super great. There was a Ruru Mono scene where a guy had a mouth in his asshole. Something had gone wrong and a mouth had emerged in his asshole and he ends up having a heart attack later and you give him mouth to mouth on his ass
mm-hmm.
at the end of the show. It was like a super funny moment.
Yeah, I've done some pretty great stuff over the years.
Yeah, yeah, you really chalked up a lot of funny moves.
I remember in a Monkey Dick practice years ago. Do you remember? I don't even remember the scene. I think this is worth saying.
We're going into practices now.
I can't. Some of the funniest shit happens in practices.
That's true.
The first beat was you were a rabbi and Rocco was a rabbi and you came out with samurais. And
right.
You come like walking towards each other with swords and then when you're like a master who's challenging him the apprentice to a duel and when you get close you pull out your fake sword you're like ha yeah 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 like parodying each other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then this kind of didn't go anywhere. And the second beat, you're both rabbis holding Torahs, and you still do the same thing. You walk up, you're like, yeah, with the Torahs.
Fighting with the Torahs.
It made me laugh. I wasn't expecting it.
Yeah.
That's all I got. That's it, 10 years.
That's it, all summed up in about 2 minutes. That's it. That's the mark you've made. But it's great. I mean, we've already said several times how hilarious you are. I think you're great. I enjoy the...
Thank you.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. That's part of the fun thing about doing ASCAT semi-regularly is I get to play with you sometimes, which is fun. I've known you for 12 years, and we've rarely gotten to do anything together. So yeah. It's always
you're
going to
be a daddy soon, too.
That's right.
I'm going to be a daddy.
Yeah, so congratulations on that.
How does that feel?
Is that completely bizarre?
That feels exciting. Also scary. You want to be able to sort of like maintain your career and, responsibilities to that, but also very excited for a child and
sure
a little
gambling,
a little life, a little cum baby, a little man from my balls.
Yeah, right.
And that she's due next month, right?
Andrea Rosen. We're speaking of Andrea Rosen.
Yeah, we're talking about Andrea Rosen, another hilarious New York City comedian whom you've seen all over the place. She's due in September or August?
August 14th.
Right in the middle of DCM. That baby could be born in the middle of DCM.
I hope it is.
Crazy. So exciting.
Yeah.
I should probably stay sober during the marathon.
Just in case.
I don't want to be all fucking whipping it out. This birth.
Your dad wasn't at your birth because he was too busy in To Catch a Predator.
I run that show. I gotta be there. I can't believe they picked up that fucking show.
It's a marathon staple, To Catch a Predator.
Who picks
prop.
Those shows?
Anthony.
Anthony King does.
I literally, the description of To Catch a Predator was... To Catch a Predator, improv edition, volume number, who cares? And the description was like, this show's never good, but it's a tradition at this point, so you can either put a bad show in the marathon or be the person who breaks the tradition. And they put it in the marathon.
Well, I think we're at the end here.
Yeah, I think so.
But John, thanks for being on our show.
Thanks so much.
It was great.
If there's anything you think of you want to talk to me about more, I could do it again.
Sure, we'll do little podlets.
Yeah.
Thank you for the desserts, for the treats.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you, Will.
You're welcome. Thank you, John.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah,
thanks,
you too.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, audience. See you here for another episode sometime soon. Thank you, Shannon O'Neill.
Yeah, thanks, Shannon.
In the background. And thank you the millions of people who came and went to the bathroom during this podcast.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.